Champaign dentist Ben Scott hasn't been paid by the state of Illinois since August of last year.
What's happened here with the state of Illinois and Delta Dental is unprecedented. Delta Dental basically said, you know, in their 150-year history, they never, ever had this happen.
Today on the 21st, the backlog of unpaid health care bills the state of Illinois owes for its workers. We'll also speak with the Better Government Association. They've been documenting how much is owed. For all of you who've been asked to pay up front, how are you handling it? We also have personal finance experts here to answer your questions about having to pay for all these unexpected healthcare costs. If you want to share your stories of having to pay, or if you have personal finance questions, give us a call. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455, or you can tweet to 21st Show. Also, Argonne National Laboratories is looking for tech and science entrepreneurs, and FEMA's investment in first responders throughout the state. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to this Wednesday edition of the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. With no budget in place, the state of Illinois is hundreds of days and millions of dollars delinquent in payments. Among those not getting paid for the past year, health care providers who serve millions of state employees. Memorial Health System is one of the biggest medical centers downstate. According to the Better Government Association, it's owed more than $80 million. The BGA also reports that Illinois dentists are owed more than $100 million by the state. We're going to be speaking with the investigator who wrote that report in a few minutes. We've seen some health care providers say they can't make it. In Champaign and Paxton, one dental practice shut its doors in April. It blamed the state's delinquencies. And many patients are having to pay upfront for their care and then wait months for the state to reimburse them. Later, we're going to be taking your questions about having to make those upfront payments. If you want to share your stories of how much you're paying, if you have comments about that, if you have questions that our personal finance experts can answer, we're here for you. You can give us a call, 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455, or you can tweet to 21st Show. Let's start with Champaign dentist Benjamin Scott. He's been practicing for years and says he's still committed to serving his patients, even though the last payment he got from the state was in August of 2015. The majority of Dr. Scott's patients are state workers. Hey, Dr. Scott, welcome to the 21st.
Well, thank you.
How much is your practice owed right now because of the state budget mess?
I don't have an exact figure, but I think it lies somewhere between $250,000 and $300,000.
Wow. And so how much has that affected you? I know you were actually an in-network provider for state employees. Does that make it harder or is that easier for you?
Well, it makes it harder when you're in network because of contract responsibilities. We have been unable to be paid any monies for services since the budget didn't pass. So, as it works out with the University of Illinois, they have the best dental insurance I've ever seen. They happen to have the advantage if they find a network dentist where for most services it's 100% coverage, less the deductible for the year, and they also have a high maximum benefit range. So it's a great thing for patients, and it would be a great thing if the state were paying its bills. However, what it does to the dentists that are in network is it's put us in a real bind with accounts receivables running out of control and, basically putting the business in the red for a long period of time while we wait to be paid for the work that we've done.
So you haven't been paid since last May. When was the last time you remember getting a payment from the state?
I think the last time we got paid was, I want to say it was either July or August of last year, just because it takes about 90 days from when the claims are posted for it to be done. So we kind of fell into that category. Now, the state has come through with some interesting things for dentists recently where all of a sudden they found some money and they paid some of the August claims have been paid.
August of 2015 claims.
Of 2015.
Okay.
But still, we do have this, almost, 12-month time. time period of no payment.
Right. And because you're in network, you can't ask your patients to pay up front, right?
That's correct. That's one of the things about the contract that Delta Dental has in place. They say if you want to have the benefit of the network and utilizing their website where patients can find you, you need to provide patients the benefits that they know they can come to a dentist office and not have to pay. It's what's happened here with the state of Illinois and Delta Dental is unprecedented. I've had many conversations with Delta Dental about it and saying, you know, you guys have to do something for us. You know, we do understand for a period of time, but when you're getting into a year and you're getting into hundreds of thousands of dollars, you know, Delta Dental understood and basically said, you know, in their 150 year history, they've never ever had this happen. And so there's talks of possibly altering the contract for, you know, very unusual circumstances like this has been. But you're correct. People, dentists that have chosen to be in network cannot get paid by patients at this point.
Dr. Scott, what percentage of your patients are state employees and in this bind?
My best estimation is it's about 70%. My practice is right in the heart of Champaign, probably only, you know, 1 to 2 miles from campus area. So I'm kind of a high traffic place for the university. So it is definitely been quite a stress.
Well, and I wonder how are you getting by while you're owed all of this money? Because you said, I mean, it's an unprecedented thing for the health for Delta Dental, but it's an unprecedented thing for you. And you're not just a dentist, but a small business owner.
Well, it's definitely been something where I've had to scramble. I've had to, it's kind of a strange situation for me in that my dental practice is doing well. It's been an established practice for a number of years. But when you look at, of course, the bank statement, it appears as one that's just starting out. What I had to do was go to, the banks that have equipment loans for me and practice loans and basically just ask them, you know, is there any possible way to pay interest only during this period? They were good enough to help me in that way, and that's kept me afloat. You know, what a lot of folks have been forced to do is get out of network, you know, where you can ask the patients for payment. And I was out of network even as much as 2 years ago. Where I had the patients pay up front. But what I was noticing is with the economy in the area, dentistry was not something that folks had a lot of extra money around to pay for. So treatment was being delayed and being done. Cleanings were being spread out, so on. So I could see that there was this giant need out there, but there really wasn't a means to pay for it. You know, and I think I would be bummed up too if I had insurance, but I had to pay 100% of it and then wait for the state to pay me 18 months later. You know, I might hesitate on doing some stuff too.
Right. So you made the business decision to go in network. And so now with all of this debt, is there any, well, not, it's not debt, it's money that's owed to you. Is there any ability for you to manage that in terms of, do you think there's any possible recourse for you? You said you've gone to Delta Dental. Obviously, we don't know when the state will be making these payments. So is there anything else you're looking into?
Yeah. I mean, I've heard a lot of different things, and I'm sure everyone else has too, about the state budget. You know, you hear rumors it won't be till November, till the next election cycle. You hear rumors maybe not even during the entire four-year term of Governor Rauner. You know, it's so unpredictable. Fortunately, a company has emerged named Healthcare Finance, and they have made an agreement with Delta Dental to buy the accounts receivables for the dentists, one of the things that happens when the state is behind in payments, they owe by law 9% interest on everything, which, you know, of course, is another thing that blows my mind. When the state is already struggling with the budget in deficit, why in the world they would allow all this 9% interest all
right
over.
As a taxpayer, it must kind of drive you crazy, right? The state's already
it's like, well, eventually when they have to pay for all this, they're going to have to do something,
and they're going to have to, and they're paying a 9% interest rate on top of that for debt that hasn't been, for debt or for money that's been owed for the past year.
Yeah, and you know, we all know there's nowhere right now that you can earn 9% interest, you know, stock market or anywhere. So it's kind of a very vexing thing for me to think about. But yeah, anyway, this company, you know, it has agreed to come in and pay about 90% of the receivables, as long as the dental professionals, I think they may also be doing this with some of the medical hospitals, as long as the person is willing to give up that 9% interest. So it's a give and take. You know, someone like me who's waited a year, you know, that interest would have been nice to cover some of the terrible things I've gone through, but at the same time, I personally can't wait any longer.
Right, so you'd just rather just take the money.
Of that option.
Dr. Scott, what happens for you, and what do you think will happen for your patients if there isn't a budget next week? And as you've said, maybe if we go through the summer, maybe even November, have you thought about that?
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty much why I've chosen the healthcare finance route for my practice, because having been out of network, I realize how valuable this has been for my patients. And I go to work every day feeling very good that I'm able to offer this to the patients. So I didn't want to drop out. So that's the direction that I'm moving regardless, because I feel like there's a potential that this could happen again next year and the following year, you know. And this way I'm covered. It's definitely not as ideal as, you know, having direct payment from the state, but it's something that I think moving forward, that's how my practice will operate. It's just kind of it's a known bum deal for so many people. And I know dentistry is just one small piece of what so many businesses are going through. And, you know, I'm glad to know that certain businesses and certain companies are making strides to try to keep Illinois afloat. And, you know, I don't know, hopefully somebody that has the ability to do something in the state can hear this broadcast, and maybe that will persuade them to move forward.
Dr. Ben Scott has a dental practice in Champaign. Dr. Scott, thanks so much for taking time to speak with us.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
As Dr. Scott said, dentistry is just one small piece of this, and it's not just state workers in Champaign. I want to correct something I said earlier. There's 60,000 state workers across Illinois. Casey Toner is an investigative reporter with the Better Government Association. BGA's Rescuing Illinois Project is what they call in-depth reports about improving and reforming state government. He's been reporting on the types of vendors and service providers who were owed $3 billion by the state. That's utilities in Springfield to drug treatment centers to services that help keep seniors in their home. He joins us now from BGA's offices in Chicago. Hi, Casey. Welcome to the 21st.
Thank you for having me.
Casey, Dr. Scott was just one dentist. You've been reporting how much the state owes dentists overall. How much does the state owe? How much is the bill just for dentists?
The bill for dentists, I believe it is $125 million. And 90% of that is owed to Illinois dentists. But there's about 17,000 dentists nationwide that kind of take care of, you know, Illinois retirees and so on and so forth.
And I wanted to go through some of the other bills. When we think about Memorial Health System, your reporting showed that they're owed more than $80 million. Do you think that's typical for large hospital systems?
Yeah, I mean, they're one where it's like a conglomeration of many hospitals, you know, so they're really hitting it kind of all together. But from what I understand, most hospitals in Illinois are just kind of hemorrhaging money right now.
And I know the interest rates are varying. Dr. Scott said, just to be clear for everybody, I know healthcare providers have a 9% interest rate that they're owed for that. So I just want to make clear, the state is also not just owes the money, but then it's going to be paying interest on all of this money that's being owed to people?
Yeah, I mean, basically, what I think is very important is the bond rating, because I think that is something that will, you know, the bond and the yield for the bond, I think is something that will really kind of crush Illinois finances for years to come. In the state of Illinois right now, the yield rate is investors are demanding about 3.4%, and that's about 1.4% higher than states with good debt, and that's something that's just going to you know, continue to nail us until we get a budget situation worked out.
Right. So we've got the one of the worst, if not the worst, bond rating in the country. And we're that's just it's an interesting thing, right, Casey, because I think we tend to think of the bond rating has to do with the pension and how much we owe on that. But now we're adding all of these other bills on top of that and then the interest rates on top of that. And that's what the rating agencies are also looking at. Right.
Right.
Yeah. Now, I know Bloomberg this morning called last year Illinois' lost year and said it's about to be lost 2 years. I mean, what is your sense of you think what the damages are to the state, not just monetary, but also non-monetary?
Well, I think that there's a lot of businesses in the state of Illinois, and I reported this out in my story, that are unwilling to do business because they just don't know when that money's coming in. So unless that money is guaranteed to them through Medicare or through some court order or something like that, you know, they're just unwilling to take it. You know, I spoke to some people that do televisual work down in Springfield, and they said that there was a contract with the Department of Human Services that they would have bid on a few years ago worth about $35,000, but they're just not doing it because they can't do the work and just not get paid. It just, you know, it'll sink them. So I think there's a lot of people that right now are
they're just waiting to be paid. Casey, we're going to take a break. If you can stick around, I'll catch up with you in just a minute. That's Casey Toner from the BGA. You're listening to the 21st.
The 21st is made possible by the Friends of WILL and by the Library at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, generating new knowledge and developing and evaluating new technologies and methodologies to better distribute scholarly knowledge. The University Library at Illinois.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're talking about the unpaid bills the state of Illinois owes for its workers. In particular, we've been talking about healthcare bills. On the line with me is Casey Toner. He's a BGA investigative reporter. We've got some personal finance, some financial certified financial planners who are here as well to talk about how to deal with these unexpected healthcare costs. So if you have questions for them, our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. We're going to get to that in just a minute again. 1-800-222-9455 if you have comments about if you are a state worker and you've had to pay out of pocket and want to share that story or have any comments about that, you can give us a call as well or tweet to 21st Show. Casey, just before the break, I wanted you to just give you a chance to finish that thought about businesses and what you think the business impact of this is for businesses who aren't being paid by the state.
Yeah, well, what I was saying is that there are people right now that are refusing to do business with the state because they just don't know when that money's coming in. I mean, I mentioned a televisual company that had done work with the state in the past few years, but now it's just refusing to unless the money is guaranteed by court order or through Medicaid or something like that. I talked to another guy that does signs, and he used to do all kinds of signs work for the state, but he just said that, you know, right now, you know, we're just not going to do it because, you know, we don't know, you know, when we're going to get paid. And then there's other businesses. There's, you know, social service agencies that have refused to take, you know, non-Medicaid patients because they don't know when the money's going to come in.
Right. And that is, and it's a good reminder for people that there are some bills that are required by law to be paid, and that includes Medicaid, right?
Right, yeah, and the total amount of bills right now that are unpaid represents about 10% of all the bills in the state of Illinois. And so that includes, you know, $3 billion with the Department of Human Services and $212 million with the Department of Aging.
And altogether, that adds up to about $3 billion?
Yeah, a little bit more than $3 billion.
Thanks for that. Casey Toner is with the Better Government Association with their Rescuing Illinois project. They've been doing in-depth reports about improving and reforming state government. Thanks, Casey.
Right, thank you.
Our phone number, 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet to 21st Show. We had a caller, Nathan from Champaign, who said he didn't actually mind paying up front because at least for a time he was getting paid back with interest more than what a bank would pay. But he says he understands why not everyone is able to afford paying up front. If you want to share your questions or comments, our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet to 21st Show. How are you dealing with these unexpected health care costs? We thought we would bring some certified financial planners in to help answer questions because there are ways to manage this. In studio with me, Ben Franklin is the Managing Director and Senior Wealth Advisor of Franklin Wealth Advisors in Champaign. Ben, welcome.
Thank you. Pleasure being here.
Thank you. On the line with us from Northfield, Illinois, Ed Jurdson is actually the National Chair of the Financial Planning Association. He's also Vice President of MAC Investment Securities. Hi, Ed.
Hey, Nella. How are you?
Good, good. Now, let's ask for folks who are dealing with this and maybe not so great. This is a situation that's been going on all year, and I think people maybe who were being asked to pay it up front unexpectedly may be surprised. There are people who have been paying up front for a while and dealing with a 9-month delay or whatever, like whatever delays they're getting. But I thought we should start with a basic personal finance question, which is how you think people should budget for unexpected health costs. Ben, let's start with you.
I'll go back to a story that I was told by my great aunt back in the 1970s. She had been a saver her entire life, and she told me that her dad told her when she got her first job, every week when you get your paycheck, set something aside in a savings account, regardless of what it is, even if it's only $5. And there used to be a time when people would make a deposit for themselves and pay themselves first just a few dollars. And so I'd say the very first thing is to establish that savings habit, even if it's just an incredibly small amount of money to start with that. Now, there are better tools for dealing with it, like flexible spending accounts, health savings accounts, Roth IRAs, that we can sure get into in detail. But just having that commitment to at least pay yourself something out of every paycheck, even if it's only a very small amount.
Ed, we know that statistically we have the lowest savings rates we've ever seen among Americans. So what advice do you have for people to even just get into that mentality of saving?
Well, you know, I love Ben's, you know, story about his great aunt, because I can tell you the clients that I have, and there's fewer and fewer of them from a Depression era, you know, always saved, because that was their mentality. Their mentality was, hey, things can go wrong, and when they do, it's really bad. So those were the savers. And as we sort of have gotten well away from that era, more and more people are relying less on paper and more on plastic, which is, you know, cash, and then more on credit. And so people are viewing their credit cards as their emergency fund, if you would. So from a savings rate standpoint, the savings rate has actually improved since the great financial recession we had, you know, in 07, 08, 09, and that is actually a good thing. But overall, it's still very low. So we tend to spend more than we save, which in times like this, in times of uncertainty, when unexpected bills come up, put us in a really bad bind.
What's a good amount to aim for saving in your emergency fund? How much salary do you think is a good goal to set aside, Ed?
Well, it's all predicated on what you do. And it's interesting because if you listen to people, they're like, well, 3 to 6 months is great. Well, that's terrific if you're a regularly salaried employee, right? If you're in sales and you deal with a commission, then you may need to be saving more. Or if you're in a field, let's say you do trading or something where you have irregular income, you definitely need to save more in case things go south. So again, it's really predicated not only on what you have, but also what's your overhead. How many people are you beholden to in terms of your debt and things like that as well? So, you know, there's general guidelines, but then you've got to be very specific about your own situation.
That's Ed Jurdson. He's National Chair of the Financial Planning Association. He's on the line from Northfield in studio with me in Champaign, Ben Franklin. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455 if you have questions for them. And Ben, you started laying out HSAs, FSAs. Before we even get to Roth IRAs, because that's another option for people, I know particularly with FSAs for University of Illinois employees, the deadline is actually coming up.
Yes.
For FSAs. It's next week. Can you explain, first of all, what an HSA is and the difference between an HSA and the FSA? Let's start with HSAs.
Okay. A health savings account is an account that someone is allowed to set up to save toward future medical expenses if they have a certain type of a health insurance plan. Has to have a high deductible, has to have a certain amount of out-of-pocket limit. It can't be a limitless plan. But there's a certain category of health plans, and if you have that type of health plan, then the government allows you on a tax, on a before-tax basis, a tax-deductible basis, to set aside money into an account from which you'll pay for medical expenses.
And can you have an HSA and an FSA or only one?
You can have both, but you have to be very careful because FSAs are employer-sponsored, right? So from that standpoint, you've got to be very careful in terms of how you handle it and how you use it. The other side is we just talked about low savings rates. So, you know, people are trying to save for their retirement, try to save and eat and, you know, pay their bills and things like that. So from that standpoint, again, if it's one or the other, you've got to be very particular about which one you choose.
So would you recommend that you ask a financial planner if you are trying to do both an HSA and an FSA, it sounds like you have to be careful about what you're eligible for and what you qualify for.
Okay, I feel that was like a layup question. Yeah,
okay.
Everybody should be seeking a certified financial planner. You know, individuals believe, well, I need to have a lot of money and a lot of wealth in order to seek out a certified financial planner. But just like good physical health, where almost everyone needs a doctor, at times you really want to seek out a certified financial planner for these questions because they're very complex and very specific to the individual and their financial situation.
And how much would it cost to meet with a financial planner for people who've never, there's different ways that people pay financial planners, right?
Yeah, there's all different ways. Some planners are hourly, some planners are on a retainer, some may charge as little as $50 a month or $100 a month. That's something that's relatively new. I know the younger generation, the next gen planners that are out there, they do a lot of that. And for most people, that's probably a really good fit.
Ben, when we're thinking about FSAs, with flexible spending account, I think a lot of people sometimes don't do it because they just don't understand or it seems complicated and they don't know the rules of it. How does a flexible spending account work?
I think the number one fear is the use it or lose it portion of the flexible savings account. That's one of the big differences between a health savings account and a flexible saving. In essence, you can set it aside during the year, but if you don't use it all, then in essence, the employer gets to keep the excess that you don't use. But the way that it works is it's done on payroll deduction, so it's the friendliest type of savings that you can do because you never see the money. It not only saves you income taxes, but it also saves you in the case of University of Illinois, it would save you the CSRS contribution. But in another person's case, it would save a Social Security contribution. So in essence, it has a value, let's say even for the lower income people, of 25% to 30% of tax savings of the money that's actually going in. And the way that it would work is you would pay the bill, you would submit the receipts to the employer, and then the employer would reimburse you up to the amount that you've set aside for the year.
So how much should you think about setting aside for the year?
The minimum at the University of Illinois is $20 per month. And the way that I usually talk to clients about it, and I do agree that a financial planner brings a tremendous amount of value to the average person, but I will tell you that your tax man, who knows you well, can also help out on how much should go into a flexible spending account. But if you know you're going to have certain out-of-pocket costs for dental, for vision, maybe for hearing, maybe for a regular checkup, those kind of things, I definitely set aside the amount that you know you're going to spend because, in essence, 25 to 30% of it's going to be paid for by tax savings.
And is there a minimum for FSAs that you have to save?
Well, the minimum, again, on
for university employees,
it's $20 per month, and it's usually set up by the human resources department of the company that you work for because it is an employer-sponsored plan, and $2,500 per year is the maximum you can have go in for medical reimbursement.
And do flexible spending accounts also include expenses like you would make for childcare?
That is part of a flexible spending account, and it's a different expense category. And its limit is $5,000.
Okay, so you could set aside your pre-tax money for childcare, but would that be a separate FSA, or is it just a separate category in one FSA?
It would be a separate category within the flexible spending account.
And what advice do you have for folks as they're thinking, especially this time of year, what kind of questions do you need to be asking yourself to determine whether or not a flexible spending account makes sense for you?
Well, it comes down to a simple spending plan. I mean, directly, it's I hate the word budget because it reminds me of the word diet, and none of us like diet, so let's call it a spending plan. It's to kind of figure out, and Ben brings up a great point. You know, most of us file taxes, you know, back in April, and so what does that mean after the fact? And so are there ways of contributing to, again, whether if it's an FSA or HSA, is there a way of contributing that to help you be able to pay for this care in a tax friendly manner? So as far as, you know, where these things sort of lie, you know, some people have FSAs available to them. If not, HSAs may be an option as well.
Ben, there's another option you said for unexpected, not just healthcare costs, but any costs, and that's
right.
a Roth IRA. Can you explain how that would work?
We really like to use a Roth IRA for our middle-income clients and especially our lower middle-income clients. There are certain tax benefits that you can get with a Roth IRA that are income dependent, but even aside from those, a Roth IRA allows you to set money aside, conceivably for retirement, but you have complete access to principal during your entire life for any purpose whatsoever. So we like to use it as a backup college savings plan in case they don't have enough saved for college, but they would like to pull out some money for children at a later point in time, and they don't have enough money to be able to set aside for two or three purposes. And as a backup plan for not only medical expenses that come up, but maybe the furnace that needs to be replaced, or they don't have money when a hot water heater goes out, or some type of other major expense that they're otherwise, as Ed said, going to have to put on plastic. And it's not only going to cost them the cost, but the cost plus the interest.
And with a Roth IRA, what are the maximum contributions you can make a year?
$5,500 if you're under the age of 50, and $1,000 more if you're over the age of 50, a catch-up provision.
And I wonder if there are other ways you think people should think about with, particularly in the under the category of unexpected healthcare costs. Are there other things we haven't talked about that people should be thinking about?
Well, whether it's unexpected health care costs, your car, I would not put college as an unexpected cost, right? Some clients all of a sudden call up and say, hey, oh, by the way, my son or daughter's going to college next year. Can you help me? That's not unexpected. But I think from a practical perspective, get a good idea of what you're surrounding yourself with. I mean, are you in a home that has a lot of old appliances, an old furnace, a new roof? This is all about planning. And so the challenging part is the plastic that we use on our credit cards to spend allows us not to have to plan so much until after the fact we have to think about paying that bill off. So it's just a mindset of the individual of just thinking a little bit more forward. Healthcare is so unpredictable. You just don't know what's going to happen. We're in the fact that things like, wow, you know, I've got a car that's got, you know, 100,000 miles on it. It's a 15-year car. Yeah, you're probably going to have car bills. So it's just being a little bit more thoughtful in terms of the future of what may lie ahead from an expense standpoint.
A quick question for you, Ben. You don't have to pay interest if you're taking out from your principal on a Roth IRA.
Right.
Now, if you're taking out the interest, then you do get hit with a really heavy penalty.
If you're taking out your gains, it's both taxable as ordinary income, plus you pay a 10% penalty if you're under the age of 59 and a half. So it's very expensive to take it out before versus after.
Question for you guys. From a financial planning standpoint, we've been talking about the state and the state paying back for healthcare providers 9% interest on how much they're owing. I'm just curious what your thoughts from that are from a financial planning perspective. Ben?
From my perspective, anytime a client can get guaranteed interest of 6% or more, I would take it, especially with as volatile as the stock market is.
Right. But I was thinking of the other way that the state
is having to. Oh, the irresponsibility of the state?
Well, that the fact that they owe the money and they're paying 9% interest on it.
It's funny because we live in a state with a constitutional amendment to balance the budget. So it boggles my mind how these kinds of things can be justified. But yes, it makes no sense at all.
We're going to have to leave it at that for right now. We've got to take a break. Thanks to Ed Dirtson, National Chair of the Financial Planning Association from Northfield, and Ben Franklin in Champaign with Franklin Wealth Advisors. Thanks, guys.
My pleasure.
Thanks, y'all.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The Mattoon, Illinois Fire Department was one of 13 fire departments across Illinois that this week received federal funding. In all, FEMA awarded $1.6 million to first responders throughout the state. For Mattoon, the East Central Illinois town will receive almost $300,000. Their fire commissioner, Rick Hall, joins us now to explain what this means for his community and what the money will be used for. Commissioner Hall, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you very much, Nyla.
I understand you all plan to use this money to purchase a rescue pumper. What is that?
Okay. A rescue pumper is a vehicle also called an all-hazard response vehicle, but it's a vehicle that's used for a couple of purposes, maybe two or three purposes. It's not only a fire truck, but it's also used for hazardous situations and emergency medical conditions. So it's a multi-purpose truck.
And how will that help you all? Because this is, I know you have two fire stations and you have emergency ambulance services as well. Does this help kind of combine costs and efficiencies for you all?
Yes, it does. There's a number of situations where we find that we have to send both an ambulance and a fire truck to a site. Those ones that might have a particular application would be automobile accidents, industrial accidents, that you might need a fire suppression vehicle or a fire truck to put out a fire, but you also might need other kind of equipment with you. So the grant for our so-called rescue pumper is something that'll be heavily utilized. It's really almost a new technology that fire departments have come out with in the last few years. We don't have a vehicle like that today, and this one will be very useful.
Does this vehicle like this cost $300,000, or are you all going to also have to provide some? Is Mattoon also going to have to provide some money to pay for this vehicle?
Well, the grant itself, which technically comes from the Department of Homeland Security Firefighters Grant, it's managed by FEMA, but the grant itself is $300,000, of which we have to match about $14,000. But the vehicle that we want to purchase is going to cost somewhere between $550,000 and $600,000. We've got a committee that's made up of firemen and also some of the fire officers, the chief and the assistant chief, that are coming up with a specific specifications of that vehicle. Because there are a number of things that we request. It's sort of like building a house where, you can just say, well, I'm going to build a house, but you've got to have a lot of details of what's in that house or what you want it to look like. Same way with this fire rescue pumper. We need to specify exactly what we want to have in it.
And how is this going to make a difference for you all? How does this grant money make a difference for Mattoon?
Okay, makes a big difference for us. Like a lot of communities in Illinois, we have to watch our budgets very closely, and we're down to the point where without this grant money, we were going to have to either delay the purchase of this piece of equipment, or we were going to have to lay off people. About 75% of our entire budget is people cost, of salaries and benefits. And we've cut things that we can cut. And now really the next thing is that if we wouldn't have received this grant, then we were going to lose one or two people in the next couple of years.
First responders.
Exactly.
Okay, so making a big difference for Mattoon. That's Mattoon Fire Commissioner Rick Hall on some funding from the Department of Homeland Security, one of several grants provided to first responders throughout the state. Thanks for being with us, Commissioner.
Thank you very much.
Argonne National Laboratories yesterday became the second national lab in the country to announce it will have its own in-house King Incubator. An incubator, for this sense at Argonne, doesn't have to do with science but business. It's an opportunity for science and tech entrepreneurs to get a kickstart for their business from the national lab. The Department of Energy and Argonne are putting $4 million behind the first cohort of teams. Joining us now from Argonne National Labs in Lamont, just south of Chicago, is Andreas Roloffs, director of the newly created Chain Reaction Innovation. Andreas, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you very much for having me.
Now, you all are billing this as a way to bridge the valley of death, you all called it, between the science workbench and the marketplace. How big is that problem?
That problem gets bigger and bigger depending on what technology you work on. If you want to write a software or you want to write an app for a phone, you probably need the basement of your parents, a couple boxes of pizza, and you're good to start your company. But if you want to work on science-based startups, if you want to make really great hardware, a new sensor, or you want to work on a new solar cell or battery, you need a lot of expensive equipment and a big team of diverse scientists. And that's really, there is not many places in the world where you could do that easily.
So what kind of support is Argonne hoping to offer this first cohort of teams then?
So there's a few things. So on one hand, the Chain Reaction Program is a two-year program, so we are looking for innovators that are very fresh innovators that have raised less than $1 million. So if it's a company that has already raised a lot of money, then that's not the program for them. But if there's a new company or an innovator that wants to come into this program, we're going to offer them access to Argonne National Lab, which is a big place, you know, with over 3,300 people here. And we give them a fellowship that comes through the Department of Energy that basically funds their salaries, healthcare benefits, and they get a couple of research dollars to spend at the lab for their ideas.
And so what kind of entrepreneurs are you looking to partner with for this?
We're looking at the people that have the science-based ideas, as I mentioned. These things that need a long time to prove out, that need expensive equipment. So if you think of, let's take a computer chip or your cell phone, anything in there uses a clean room, and that's not easy. Even if you get the money from somebody to say, that's a great idea, I want to fund that, you still need to build up the capabilities, hire a diverse team of people, and get the tools up and running. And there's a lot of equipment at Argonne that people could use.
And when you say clean room, what do you mean by that?
Oh, sorry. Clean room is actually a room, and the name describes it very well. That's a room that is very, very clean. There's no dust particles in it, because when you want to make a tiny microchip, a dust particle to these structures is the size of a rock, basically. And so you have to be in a very, very clean environment, and it's very expensive to build these kinds of laboratories. And so we have laboratories like this on site, or chemical labs. We have a big X-ray machine that you could look inside an operating system, for example.
And do you think that's why there is this so-called valley of death between scientists who have ideas like this and then taking them and making them into successful companies? Is a lot of it, maybe not capital, because we hear a lot about access to capital, but for startups. But do you think if for scientists there are special challenges that have to do with the technology they need to create their products?
There might be multiple reasons for why there is this gap, but a scientist has the idea of trying to find new things. There's not the idea, if you do basic science, it's not directed at I want to build something. This is more I want to understand something. I want to get deeper into understanding nature. But the people that actually want to build something, there were labs like Bell Labs. If you go several years back, there were these big laboratories that did hardware development. And I came over to the U.S. Several years back, and I worked for a company in a research lab, and that got closed. So many of these large corporations are closing their research labs. And so David Danielson, who is the assistant secretary at the Department of Energy for what is it called, energy efficiency and renewable energy, so he called it the lost generation. So there's really, we are now in the place where we are closing more and more of these labs and industry, and these innovators that want to do science-based startups have not really a place to go. that is really a problem that's increasing.
And that's because you're saying private companies, there's a lot of research and development costs into developing these things. And is that something you see more and more shifting to government investment in research and development for technology, and then by extension, national laboratories like Argonne?
Yeah, that's what we see, and I think that's why we created these centers. And the problem is that everything in a company is geared towards making money, and you have to basically, even in the development, if you come up with a new product that year, in 3 years it has to hit the market. But if you want to have a new technology that has big societal impact, so it's very risky to try those out. And
Andreas? Looks like we're having a hard time getting a hold of Andreas. Let's try to get him back in just a second here. Sorry about that. You're listening to The 21st. And Andreas, you back?
Yes.
Hi there. Sorry about that. Okay.
Yeah, maybe that's a company that could develop better cell phone technology.
Better cell phone technology. Okay, there's an idea for an entrepreneur for Argonne. But you were saying before we lost you there just about the time it takes to get a product to, and you're saying a lot of times there's kind of a profit margin, or they're thinking, well, we've got to get this ready within 3 years. What I wanted to ask you about was how you are going to, I think this is a traditional problem with incubators and startups. How are you going to measure success of applicants in the program? How are you going to, it's a 2-year program. What's your goal for an entrepreneur comes in with an idea at the end of 2 years? What do you want them to have to show for that?
Yeah, I think the whole trick is part of these 2 years is definitely the technical development of that idea to a point where you have proof of concept that an investor from the outside that really looks at, is that a profitable product in any time frame that they are willing to invest in, so that product is at that stage. But during that time, they also should go and get a pitch ready, pitch to investors and try to raise more money. So these 2 years is learning also entrepreneurship. And entrepreneurship is what is the value of the product, who's your customer, and how much is it going to cost to produce that product. So there will be multiple things. One is developing the technology. Another one is raising the money, and raising the money is also the business piece, and that's what we hope to teach them in 2 years and work with them together on developing the technology.
So someone who's listening now and thinks, maybe I want to be involved in this, who are you looking for? What applicants? What do applicants need to demonstrate about their idea for them to be accepted into this first cohort?
Yeah. So first of all, I'm really happy that I'm on the call, because I want to shout out to all the people that are in science and have a science background, and the students and postdocs. I think that's where most of the people will come from. And it's going to be a relatively easy proposal that is something like 5 pages, where we want to know where do they come from, what was the education, what is the idea, why do they think Argonne could help. Because most valuable will be people that actually work in an area where we have good expertise. Because then it's not only the tools, but we have also scientists they can collaborate with. And that gives the likelihood of success a big boost, I think.
Andreas, how do people apply?
It's on our website, Chain Reaction Innovations at Argonne National Lab. If people look for that, they find a website, and there's a button that says more information for entrepreneurs. In about 2 weeks, we're going to go live with the full solicitation, and then we start the process of looking into the proposals.
That's Andreas Roloffs, director of the newly announced, as of yesterday, Chain Reaction Innovations, Argonne National Laboratory's first ever tech and science business incubator. We'll tweet out all that information as well. So if you follow The 21st, or if you head to our website at 21stshow.org, we'll have all of those links. Andreas, thanks so much for taking the time to chat with us.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
That does it for our show today. A comment that we got from a listener about our earlier conversation about dentists. Steph says, thanks to 21st for covering the subject and wanted to add an anecdote regarding the use of an HSA. Steph planned to pay with an HSA debit card at the dental office, had lots of problems. It took 6 months before the budget impasse just for them to get the bill, he says, and then that led to multiple notices from our HSA and the threat of freezing our HSA account. Lots of calls. Steph says this problem seems specific to the state of Illinois' HSA plan and says, I wonder now if pre-tax money is of less value than having the income taxed and conservatively invested. It certainly seems like the money would be easier to access. We'll have the whole conversation from today about HSAs, FSAs, and all of that up on our website. If you head to 21stshow.org, it'll be up there in a couple of hours, and you can listen to the whole conversation. As always, we welcome feedback. You can do it on our Facebook page like Steph did. All of the information for our Facebook, Twitter, phone number is at 21stshow.org. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening to The 21st.